Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
On manque d'ouvriers spécialisés dans le monde entier. Le métavers peut contribuer à résoudre ce problème. La plateforme de formation en réalité virtuelle de ForgeFX permet aux futurs soudeurs de s'entraîner encore et encore. Ils apprennent ainsi les compétences nécessaires pour débuter et faire évoluer leur carrière. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
Cataracts are the world's leading cause of avoidable blindness. The metaverse can help address that problem. A virtual reality platform created by Fundamental VR and Orbis International, helps train doctors to treat cataracts, resulting in more confident surgeons operating all over the world. With virtual reality training, surgeons can practice over and over to gain skills. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 17th of March, these are our main stories. Russia's elections are not going entirely according to plan, with polling stations facing sabotage attempts and the country suffering yet more attacks from Ukraine. We'll be hearing how Russians are voting in neighbouring Latvia and Estonia.
I voted for Putin. He's closer to my viewpoint. I understand him. I have no doubts about him.
India has announced the date of its general election. And the Iranian scholar and political activist arrested. No reason given. Also in this podcast, Egypt's vast film and television industry has suffered a blow, with the country's biggest studio destroyed by a fire.
This is a cinematography studio that TV shows used to film, TV series in Ramadan, and films as well. The place is always active and nobody knows what happened.
And why the French banquet has become a more frugal feast. It was supposed to be a demonstration of how smoothly things are running in Russia, despite its war with Ukraine. But this weekend's election is not going entirely according to plan. There have been attempts to sabotage polling stations, one of them even catching fire. Russia's former president, Dmitry Medvedev, said those responsible were traitors. Then there are the ongoing attacks from Ukraine, a cross-border raid, and continuing missile attacks on targets inside Russia. That was the air raid siren going off in Belgorod, a region of Russia which borders Ukraine. A missile attack there killed two people. Russia said Ukraine was engaged in terrorist activities. Meanwhile, the Belgorod governor, Vyacheslav Gladkov, ordered that children remain at home.
We will poll all parents who bring their children to the duty groups in kindergartens. We will ask, if possible, for the children to stay at home on Monday and Tuesday. Of course, safety is the primary concern for all of us.
When Vladimir Putin makes his stirring, would-be patriotic speeches, he's often expressed concern for ethnic Russians who live outside the country, mainly in neighbouring states which were once part of the Soviet Union. Take Estonia, for example. About a quarter of the population there speak Russian. Indeed, some remain Russian citizens. And as Oleg Boldierev reports, many of them have been crossing the border into Russia to cast their vote in the current election.
Here in Estonian border town of Narva lies the frontier between the Western world and Russia. Across the river, with its formidable fortress, lies Ivangorod, a town 170 kilometers away from St. Petersburg. And this is one but a handful of places where the border between EU and Russia is still open. What's even more unusual that in this place and the surrounding region, thousands of people are, in fact, Russian citizens. This is the legacy of Soviet Union breakup. In the 1960s and 1970s, people were brought from Soviet Union to work in local industries. And after the collapse of Soviet Union, they failed to get Estonian citizenship. This is the source of bitter arguments between the residents and the Estonian authorities, but the fact is that these people have applied and got Russian passports, and this means they can go and vote in the presidential elections which are taking place right now. There weren't any big queues on this side of the border. We tried and looked for people who would cross over and vote, and most people were turning away. They're clearly not willing to talk about this. They're afraid that if they admit that they voted, this will somehow mean trouble for them. But one woman named Anna was not afraid to talk.
За Путина. Мне он ближе, он мне понятен. У меня характер такой.
I voted for Putin. He's closer to my viewpoint. I understand him. I have a sister there. My husband's brother is there. Our relatives are buried there. To cut us apart is painful.
We spoke to several more people who confirmed that they crossed the bridge and that they voted and they supported Mr. Putin. Their votes didn't matter much for Mr. Putin. His victory in this election is a foregone conclusion. Narva illustrates a very complex situation the Baltic states are in, nervously watching over their giant neighbours to the east, Russia.
Oleg Boldyarev there. Next door to Estonia, many of Latvia's sizable ethnic Russian population also have a right to vote. However, they will cast their ballot at the Russian embassy in the capital, Riga. Our correspondent there, Sergei Goryashko, told me that the Latvian authorities stand accused of hindering the voting process.
Latvian police claim that they're going to check the documents of those people who come to the polling stations on Sunday to check if they are in the country legally, so if they possess visa or residence permits. Russian officials are claiming that this is an interference by Latvia in the elections. Of course, Latvian officials criticize the election themselves. They claim that they are rigged and that their result is predicted already. They consider the whole presidential election in Russia as an illegal event.
What is the situation for ethnic Russians living in Latvia? Can they openly show support for Vladimir Putin or for Russia's invasion of Ukraine, or do they tend to feel they need to keep quiet?
In Riga itself, in the Latvian capital, there are no many people who openly support Vladimir Putin. However, there are some who do. I haven't found any willing to talk publicly about their support of Vladimir Putin, but we could look at the results of the previous Russian presidential election in 2018. According to the results from the polling station in Latvia and the Russian embassy, around 94% voted for Vladimir Putin there. So there are definitely some people who do support Vladimir Putin who live here in Latvia. Of course, there have been numerous violations at the polling stations, and of course, the results could be rigged. However, independent observers claim that usually at the Russian embassies, the staff doesn't bother themselves trying to rig the results of the elections. So the results at the polling stations abroad can be considered as real. This is why Latvian officials are so bothered with the election now, because they know that here in the country, there is definitely a number of people who do support Vladimir Putin, and they show that support, for instance, at the election.
Sergei Goryashko in Latvia. The dates for the Indian general election have been announced. It'll take place on seven dates from the 19th of April to the 1st of June. Our correspondent Samira Hussain has more details about what's often described as the world's largest democratic exercise.
I'm actually in the very busy Janpat market in Delhi. There are lots of people out. The weather is perfectly temperate. Now, what they've done is they've divided the country into seven different phases, and each phase will have their time to go and vote. You have one area that will encompass some northern states, some southern states, and some eastern states. And these states will go and vote in the first phase. And that's how they go on with these elections. Because remember, we're talking about a country that has 960 million eligible voters in this 2024 election. Pulling it off is really quite a feat, which is why it takes so long to actually get every vote counted. The expectation is the results should come out by the 4th of June. Last election, which was 5 years ago, we saw that the voter participation rate was at 67%. And I've just come from a press conference with the Election Commission. One of their goals for this particular election is actually to further increase that participation rate. And what they're trying to do is to really make sure that they increase the voter participation, especially among young people, new voters, and among women. Of course, the north is absolutely dominated by Prime Minister Modi's BJP party. But if you look at the south and other areas in the country, there is actually regional opposition to the Prime Minister. So whether the increased voter participation will benefit him, it really depends on where these voters are coming from.
Samira Hussain. So it seems to be over. 3 months after an Indian cargo ship was captured by Somali pirates, the Indian Navy has taken it back. All 35 pirates, it says, were forced to surrender, and the 17 crew were rescued without injury. With more details, here's our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasan Ethirajan.
The cargo ship Ruwan was seized off the coast of Somalia in December, and since then it was being tracked by international maritime forces. The Indian rescue operation involved drones and marine commandos dropped from the air. It was conducted almost 2,600 kilometers away from the Indian coast. Since January, the Indian Navy has intercepted 2 hijacked vessels, rescuing 38 crew members kidnapped by pirates. India has deployed at least a dozen warships along with other nations to provide security against pirates in the Western Indian Ocean this year. India is not part of the US-led task force protecting vessels from Houthi attacks in the Red Sea. But an expert said the Indian Navy was doing classic police work patrolling the northern and western Arabian Sea.
Ambarasan Ethirajan. It's sometimes known as Hollywood on the Nile. The Egyptian film industry pumps out hundreds of productions every year, watched across the Arab world. In fact, that comparison with Hollywood is a little misleading, as the first silent films were made in Egypt at the end of the 19th century, before all those West Coast American movie makers got in on the act. In recent years, television production has also become prominent in Egypt. Here's an excerpt from the epic series Al Mualam about a man seeking revenge after he was wrongfully imprisoned. Al Mualam is just one of the TV shows which was filmed at the Al Ahram Studios in Cairo, which has now been destroyed by fire. And this is not merely a blow for Egypt. Al Ahram is one of the largest and oldest film studios in the world. Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, told me first about the extent of the damage.
It was very, very big fire, spectacular images of it, which Egyptians woke up to earlier this morning. The Prime Minister, the Culture Minister have all been to visit the site. This is a big area. There's 3 studios there. One of the studios appears to have been destroyed. Importantly, though, the archives, the Culture Minister said, are still intact. In fact, that clip you played of Al Mualim, that is what was being filmed just hours before this fire hit. It was a huge production for this Ramadan. It's actually going out as we speak now. So it's a big fire that will stop Al Ahram from some of the production it's doing, but it's not going to wipe it out for good.
For those who don't know, just tell us a bit about why this studio is so important, not just in Egypt, but certainly across the Arab world.
Well, it's one of a crop of studios in Cairo and around there which appeared over the past 50, 60 years. This one goes back 80 years. It was set up in 1944 by 2 Greek businessmen. So it saw the great flourishing of the Egyptian film industry when Egypt was the centre of the Arab world culturally. For example, Yusuf Shaheen, one of the great Egyptian directors and actors, he produced one of his most iconic, one of his most legendary films there, Cairo Station.
Okay, so that's the past. Egypt cinema was still growing great guns. Do you think with Al Ahram suffering such terrible damage, will they be able to continue? I mean, is that it for production there?
Well, I mean, the golden age is over of Egyptian cinema. We're talking the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. What has replaced it is the TV industry. And that is still a major part of what Egypt produces. Al Ahram, I'm sure, will continue in one form or another. There are other studios which are perhaps more important than Al Ahram these days. And we've seen beyond Egypt, we see now in Lebanon, in Syria and other countries, they are just as important in the production, not just of those series during Ramadan, but of film. So Egypt still is very important, but it's not standing astride above everything else in the Arab world culturally.
Sebastian Usher. Now to a new play opening here in London on Sunday, which is unique in many ways. It has the arresting and rather provocative title Mad Women, the life and death of three women artists living with bipolar. Here's a flavour.
I'm so sorry for breaking your heart like this.
Perdona por romperte el corazón de esta manera. One day, I won't be here. I'm tired of hospitals, of drugs, of waking up in the middle of the night in pain.
What if today becomes that day? I'll be gone.
The play is inspired by the lives of three female Latin American artists, Frida Kahlo, Violeta Parra, and Judith Marquez, and it charts their mental health, looking at the way women and men are often treated differently when it comes to mental illness. The play's author and director of the new production, Costanza Olachami, told Lise Doucette what made her tackle this subject.
I got interested in mental health because of my own experience. I had a crisis in some point of my life, and my way to deal with it and cope with it was writing. And I always say that I write not to be mad. I wrote the first monologue, these are three monologues, and the first monologue about Violeta Parra, because she's Chilean and I am Chilean. And she was a pioneer in folk music and in many other things, but also had a very hectic life. And I was always interested in her life because for many more conservative Chileans, it was like, yeah, she was like promiscuous and, you know, and
Judging her.
And I was like, no, I mean, I want to do some research. So I wrote this monologue, which is a fictional portrayal of her life and death. It's basically a journey. I opened it and I had an amazing reaction from the female audience. And many women approached me every night and said, like, well, thank you. This is the first time that we see women's mental health portrayed in a way that is not patronizing or stereotypes or just condescending. So it's honest.
And you went on to choose someone who is quite well known, Frida Kahlo.
Yes.
Mexican artist, very successful, but known to have mental health issues. And Judith Marquez. So all three women are artists, but they had mental health issues of a kind.
Yes. If you read Frida Kahlo's letters, so I read all her letters, and there is a big book, and also her diary. And yes, you can see there were mental health challenges for her. She wrote to her therapist, even in some episodes of her life. She was depressed many times, but she was also in this mood that she was like kind of big personality. It's basically a journey through their art to say, hey, you, society, you have judged us. If a man artist has a mental health condition, he's a genius. Leave him because he is in a creative moment.
Yes, they often say, oh, you have to be a bit mad to be really, really brilliant, and it's seen as a positive.
Exactly. Mm. But for women, they are hysterical, yeah. You know.
So you have many different eyes on this. You're Chilean, but you live in London. Is this a Latin American portrayal? Is the way these issues are treated different in that region than they are, say, here in Britain or America or any other parts of the world? Or are they universal?
I think they are universal. And that's why I was surprised that people approached me when the first monologue was open. Because, yes, Latin America has high levels of domestic violence and femicide.
Killing of women by men.
Yeah. By their partners, usually. But the topics are universal.
Costanza Olachami speaking to Lise Doucette. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
This is a dream come true. I have been asked about Glastonbury now for years, and it's finally coming together.
The country star Shania Twain prepares to wow Glastonbury, one of the world's biggest live music events. A court in Hong Kong has handed down prison sentences of up to 7 years to a group of 12 people, all convicted in connection with the storming of the city's legislature. It happened at the height of anti-government protests 5 years ago. Most have been found guilty of rioting, as Martin Yip reports from Hong Kong.
families and friends were seen weeping in the public gallery as the convicted protesters were led away by prison guards. Those sentenced included the actor Gregory Wong and the former head of Hong Kong University's Student Union, Althea Soon. All of them were among hundreds of people who broke into the legislature on the 1st of July 2019. Some protesters sprayed political slogans on the walls and tore up copies of the city's mini-constitution. The judge said these acts did not just cause physical damage, but also challenged the rule of law and undermined the government's integrity.
Martin Yip. It's usually obvious why women are arrested in Iran. Not wearing the right clothes, for example, can easily get you locked up. Or being somewhere with a man who's not a member of your family. What's often not clear is why someone's arrested at a particular time. Take Sadiqeh Vazmaki, for example, a prominent scholar of Islam and political activist. She's frequently appeared in public without the hijab. Yet on Saturday morning, she was suddenly taken into custody. Sabas Nazari from the BBC's monitoring service told me this could be because of shifts in Iran's government, rather than anything Ms. Vazmaki had done recently.
The arrests and raids that take place depend usually upon the political environment, the social situation on which the intelligence ministry and the Revolutionary Guard usually decide. But there is a certain fact here that they didn't do this before the elections, which happened earlier this month, because the Iranian government actually wanted to heat up the environment for the elections and did not want to continue the crackdown, which has been going on over the past 2 years, just trying to appease the society and project a more relaxed image of the environment. So the arrest today is probably an indication that this long arm could reach anyone, and it's not just about the ordinary members of the public. Someone with prominence, someone who is a jurist and can challenge the religious aspects of this controversial hijab dress code could also be arrested and cannot be spared in this crackdown. This showdown, if you will, has been happening on the streets because the Iranian women, especially after the outbreak of the unrest, have found themselves in a better situation in terms of expressing their courage. Despite all the repressive measures that the ruling system has adopted, they continue to show this defiance, and the ruling establishment is finding itself in a state of tug of war with them, and it's somehow deadlocked. On the one hand, we have these women who are out on the streets. On the other, we have hardliners who are working on a bill which is aimed at imposing a new set of laws to actually establish the rule of hijab in the society.
Sabas Nazari from the BBC's monitoring service. In Britain, the devolved government in Wales is set to be led by a black politician for the first time, after Vaughan Gething was elected as leader of the local Labour Party. He's expected to succeed Mark Drayford as First Minister once he officially steps down next week. Mr. Gething had this reaction.
Today, we turn a page in the book of our nation's history, a history that we write together. Not just because I have the honour of becoming the first black leader in any European country, but because a generational dial has jumped too. And I want us to use this moment as a starting point for a more confident march into the future.
Gareth Lewis now looks back on Mr. Gething's rise to the top of the Welsh Government.
Humphrey Vaughan ap David Gething's route to the Art Deco First Minister's office, looking out over a park in central Cardiff, has been an unusual one. He was born in Zambia in 1974. His father, from Ogmore by Sea near Bridgend, was a vet and his mother a Zambian chicken farmer. When he was two, the family moved to the UK after his father was offered a job in Abergavenny. But when he arrived with his black family, that offer was withdrawn. They moved to Dorset instead, and later Mr. Gething went to university in Cardiff and Aberystwyth. This is where he first came to political prominence, speaking to the BBC in the late 1990s about his opposition to tuition fees.
Tuition fees are a detriment to access. They do damage access. They do put people off.
Vaughan Gething's early experiences have shaped his politics. As the first black leader of a European nation, he's spoken eloquently about the message his election would send. He knows, he says, what it's like to experience prejudice and have your place in the community questioned. One of his aims is that nobody in Wales should feel that way again.
Gareth Lewis. Imagine for a moment you are a king or queen. You spend considerable time wandering the globe, visiting other countries where you are feted by the great and the good. And this inevitably involves a state banquet. Now, where would you expect the finest of these to be held? You might guess it would be France, and the French have in the past laid on spectacular feasts, with more courses than many people manage to eat in a week. But those days are, it seems, past, with French banquets becoming rather more frugal. We know about this trend because an auction is being held of menus from French banquets down the ages. Our Paris correspondent, Hugh Schofield, told me first how things used to be.
You know, 150 years ago, when this collection was first begun, or where the oldest menus come from, the state dinners were absolutely unrecognisable from today. There would have been masses of dishes of a very heavy and undigestible to today's palates kind. And gradually, over the years, that has changed. Just before the Second World War, when, for example, King George VI of England and the woman, his wife, who became the Queen Mother, went, you know, they had a banquet which was already scaled down from the, you know, the early standard, and that still had 15 courses. So there's been a gradual move away from these very, very heavy, stodgy, excessive meals, where I think people were only expected to take a little, tiny portion of all of this array of different foods, down to what is a far more simple and modern taste, where in the banquet given by Macron to King Charles III, there were just four courses. There was fish, main course cheese and gâteau, all extremely beautiful, beautifully prepared and so on. But that was it. Compare that to, as I say, 1938, where, you know, you get down to the trimballe de caille farcie à la Talleyrand, fourth course, and you're only a third of the way through the meal.
So what's going on? I mean, is this... Are the French worried about the bill for the food at the end of it? Why are they becoming just a bit more frugal?
It's changing taste. It certainly would have been vastly more expensive to prepare all that stuff. But, I mean, it's just not done like that anywhere anymore. I mean, the nobility, the sort of families that would have done this in a kind of ordinary way have disappeared. It's not part of modern life. And on top of that, of course, there are all sorts of new considerations about health, about what's good for you, about what the purpose of a meal is. I mean, back then, people would have sat around for hours and it could have lasted 3 or 4 or 5 hours, a big banquet. Nowadays, you know, much less time and much more of a focus on the quality and on the sort of health of the recipient, shall we say, of the banquet.
Hugh Schofield. The Canadian singer Shania Twain has joined a select group of musicians. It's been announced she'll play the Legends slot on the famous Pyramid Stage at the Glastonbury Music Festival in the west of England. Among her predecessors to receive this honour are Johnny Cash, Kylie Minogue, Dolly Parton and Diana Ross. All have basked in the afternoon sunshine or sometimes pouring rain in front of tens of thousands of fans. The BBC's Joe Wiley has been to more Glastonbury festivals than most, and has been looking back at the Legends slot.
Ah, let's sing about her.
The Legends slot, I think, has just evolved. So there was a moment, maybe 20 years ago, and it was this certain slot where heritage artists who were revered and they were established and much loved by so many different people. And it just felt right that they sat nicely on a Sunday afternoon. It fitted the mood and it fitted the tempo of the weekend. Everyone was a little bit, you know, exhausted from dancing and partying for the entire weekend. So to have Johnny Cash playing in front of you, just serenading you on a Sunday afternoon, felt absolutely right.
I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when he stays through.
I remember when Dolly Parton played and there was a crowd of 100,000 people, the biggest crowd I've ever seen apart from Elton last year. And they all turned up to just worship at the altar of Dolly and to sing along all her greatest hits. And she hammed it up brilliantly.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by.
Quite a lot of the artists who play in the Legends slot are American, so I don't think Glastonbury is translated particularly through to them what it's all about. So when Lionel Richie turned up and he saw this big field of festival goers, like enormous, and he walks out on stage and he's played to anybody and everybody, hasn't he? But his experience, he at one point actually said, Glastonbury, what the hell is going on here? And I was really lucky to just catch him moments after he'd walked off stage.
That was as good as it gets. Even after all the years of me performing, when a crowd takes over like that and shows that much love and they know every song, and then when I saw my face in every imaginable form, it was the perfect show.
Hey,
There's been so much speculation about who is going to be the legend this year, ranging from Chaka Khan, Barbra Streisand, Cher. Everybody wanted to know who is going to be on that Sunday afternoon, and it has been revealed to be Shania Twain, and it's fair to say that she is wildly excited.
This is a dream come true. I have been asked about Glastonbury now for years, and it's finally coming together. I'm packing my willies and my raincoat and, of course, my cowboy hat. So I'll see you in the beautiful Somerset countryside. This summer, can't wait. This is huge. Honor of my life. I'm so excited.
Man, I feel like a woman.
Shania Twain ending that report by Joe Wiley, and this year's festival runs for 5 days at the end of June. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Kozaris, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.